10th, 2021. This is our third and final case set for oral arguments. It is A20-0913, Sandra D'Antonio et al. Versus Jennifer Lynn Martinez et al. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose to use that time. A couple logistic. First and foremost, thank you both for joining us via zoom.gov. We appreciate you doing this. We prefer to be meeting in person, but right now we have an order from the Chief Justice to only have hearings virtually. And so this is how we are doing it. This is being recorded. No other recordings are permitted, either audio or video. If we run into any issues, any technical issues at all, we'll make sure that we address them so that all the parties have adequate time to make their arguments. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Nick Clare. Last name is spelled K-L-E-H-R on behalf of Appellant Martinez. May it please the court, counsel. As you know, in this matter, what we're dealing with is two particular issues. The first issue is whether the trial court erred or there was an abuse of discretion in granting respondents' motion to remove a third party, in this case, a building owner or a landowner, from the special verdict form at trial. And then the second issue is whether the trial court erred in determining that workers' compensation benefits that were paid to respondent Sandra D'Antonio were not collateral sources. And I would like to deal with the first matter, the abuse of discretion on the special verdict form regarding the negligence issue, judges.
And obviously for the negligence issue, you have to demonstrate that there's a duty on behalf of the building owners. So we've all read the record. What are your strongest points to even establish? You have a prima facie obligation to establish that. What's the showing of negligence?
Yeah, and I think
that's, do we even know who the building owners are?
Well, we did know who the building owners were. It was part of public record. We did not put that in, Judge. I don't think that, and Judge Werke, I think that's an excellent question, and it was one of the first things that I was going to, is to establish what do we need, first of all, to get to the jury? And just as you indicated, Judge Werke, you need a prima facie case of negligence. And in this case, we know that there's a landowner or a building owner. There's no dispute on that. What the name is, it doesn't matter, really, because they're not going to be bound by this verdict. So let me at least get to that question first, Judge. Typically in a negligence case, negligence is a fact question for the jury, but we do know that there's a duty here, judges, because even the respondents in their brief, and I have it here, it's under page 11 of their own brief, they specifically indicate that a landowner or a building owner, but a landowner has a duty to use reasonable care to prevent persons from being injured by conditions on the property that present foreseeable risk of injury.
But that's my point. What were the conditions on the property? You had darkness. And that's saying, well, on our comparative negligence special jury verdict, let's say is the darkness liable or contributorily, comparatively negligent?
Yeah. The lighting conditions are the negligence, Your Honor. There's evidence that was in the record that indicate that these lights in this parking lot at that time of day were always working and fully.
I need to call you out on that. I didn't see any evidence in the record on why the lights were not on, other than D'Antonio's inferred belief that daylight savings time had changed. I tell me where the testimony was that said why the lights were not on.
Yeah, and Judge, the lights were. I don't know, other than what Miss D'Antonio indicates, that it could have been daylight savings time. You're right. I don't know why the lights weren't on, but that's not the prima facie case to get to a jury. That goes to the weight of Mr. Tierney to go to the jury and go, well, wait a minute here. We know that there's a duty of a landowner to keep those lights on. If they put them on in the first place and it fully illuminated that parking lot to allow...
I'm really picking on you. How do we know... How do we know those lights were the responsibility of the building owner as compared to street maintenance, a city? Where is that in the record?
Well, that's the law, Judge, and I don't pick the law. The law is the landowner has the duty, and they can have a contract with a third party. They can have a contract with some other general contractor to keep those lights on, but that duty... Once they put those parking lot lights in there to illuminate people's path to their building that they're receiving rent for. Now, we don't know if they're receiving rent, but again, that's the issue here is whether they're receiving
rent. My point would be this. If I owned a building, I'd probably hire somebody to maintain my property and take care of the lights and do everything necessary. So, you know, in that case, if you were seeking a comparative negligence position on the special verdict, wouldn't you go after the people that are responsible for doing it versus coming back to me or the building owner?
Yeah,
I'm trying to figure out how I can leap from one to the other because there's no testimony about any of that.
Yeah, and I think that's a good question, Judge, and I think that's one of the issues here. But the problem... Well, it's not a problem. Under the law, the landowner has that duty. They can't delegate that duty to somebody else. They may be able to bring a separate action against a building maintenance company, such as if you own a building, Judge Werke, and you have parking lot lights that are in that building and they fail to work for whatever reason, the maintenance person you hired or contracted to keep those lights on didn't get up that morning. That does not excuse you from having those lights on as a landowner. You may have an excuse to your negligence, but at least the threshold question of, and what the threshold question is, what are the elements of negligence? And in a fact question to a jury, I'm not saying that it's a low standard, but the standard is the law. Is there a duty? Yes. Even respondents agree there's a duty of a landlord. Was there a breach? Well, we know that the lights weren't on, and there was testimony from Miss D'Antonio herself that indicated for the months and weeks before this time, in that time frame, those lights were always on and aided me, and I had no issues getting from my car in the parking lot to the building. So when those lights are off, there's a breach.
Mr. Kerr, I actually want to stop you right there because when we're talking about testimony, when I looked at the testimony of Ms. Martinez, she testified that the parking lot was dark like every other morning. She also testified that even if the parking lights were on, they would not have lit the crosswalk. The parking lights shown a light behind the crosswalk, not actually on the crosswalk. And perhaps most significantly, both parties actually agreed that the lights from the building lit the crosswalk. So that seems counter to the whole argument that it was dark, it was dark, it was dark, and the building owner had a responsibility to make sure it wasn't dark. Both parties actually agreed that the lights from the building lit the crosswalk area. So why is that even an issue?
Well, if you look at the record, Judge, and I think that's a very good point, what we have in the record under document 101, I think it's the opening arguments, is this is respondents saying this accident happened at 6 to 6:15 in the morning. And I'm just quoting here. Mr. Tierney says to the jury, it was dark. It was morning. There's usually lights on in this parking lot. That day there were not. It was dark. And if you go on through the rest of the testimony with respondent.
Okay, but Mr. Kerr, let me stop you there because I understand that the thrust of your argument is it was dark. And 6 a.m., I understand that. But how do you address the issue of both parties agreeing that the lights from the building actually lit the crosswalk area? That seems to indicate that despite the fact that it was dark out because it was early in the morning, you could actually see the crosswalk area.
Right. And Judge Reyes, that's a fact question for a jury to determine whether those lights would have helped aided, because there was testimony from my client specifically that that area would typically be better lit with the lights on. And not only that, it's not just at the point of that impact, Judge. It's, and I know you don't have an aerial view, but when you drive into 5050 Lincoln Drive, which was part of the record and photographs, that area is fully lit up, and a driver coming into the parking lot can see pedestrians walking from their car and at least have some particular notice that somebody's heading towards the crosswalk at that point in time to give additional notice. Now, that goes to negligence, and that's a fact question, in my opinion, Judge, for the jury. And I see I have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to get to my second point if I could, unless there's some additional questions on this issue by the panel. The second issue is the workers' compensation payments. And the payments that were made here, they were collateral source payments. There's no doubt about that under the law. I think what the respondents
But there was a subrogation claim that was made. I mean, you're acknowledging that, right?
Yeah, and there was, but the appellant or my client still has the right to dispute whether that's a work-related injury under the law and by the facts. Under the statute, they do. The employer and the insurer have to, any payments in a workers' compensation case, any payments that are made have to be made pursuant to the statute or to the act, meaning that it had to arise out of a work-related injury. And appellant still has the ability to say, you need to prove that. Now, typically, sometimes in these cases, there's a stipulation because we know it's a work-related injury. But in this case, even prior to trial on the record, I informed not only the trial court, but the respondents in this matter that there was a dispute there. That's not my client's burden of proof.
What is your authority that a court could make a post verdict ruling on whether there was a work, whether this was work related or not? Do you have any authority or anything to point us to?
Well, the authority that I have to point you to is the Supreme Court decision of Kubaczewski. And basically in that case, and I can read the holding, the specific holding in that case was, and I'll quote, accordingly, we hold that Minnesota Statute 176.061, Subdivision 7 and Subdivision 10, and those subdivisions are the indemnity right of a workers' comp carrier to get subrogation from a third party for negligence. And they say, those subdivisions do not give the employer insurer an independent right of indemnity against a tortfeasor for benefits mistakenly paid by the employer for a non-work-related injury. They have to prove that this was a work-related injury first before they obtain that subrogation right against my client. And there's nothing in the record in this case that these benefits paid arose out of a work-related injury. So therefore, their workers' compensation benefits paid under the statute, they're definitely collateral source issues, or it's a collateral source, but it doesn't automatically, just subrogating against my client doesn't automatically give the indemnity right to a tortfeasor such as my clients for any benefits. And under the statute, it says, under mistake of law or mistake of fact. And that's what we have here.
How do we, as we're obviously a reviewing court, an error correcting court, how do we make this determination when it wasn't ruled on by the district court? What are we to do with it? What are we to make of it?
Well, it was ruled on by the district court that this was a collateral source, but basically what the trial court said is this is, since there's a subrogation action, that it's not a collateral source and my client would have to pay that. That's the error in the law. The law is that they have to first prove it's a work-related injury, and either by stipulation or by motion, or put it on the verdict form. And that's not, there was no Travelers, the workers' compensation carrier, didn't intervene in this matter, and they definitely could do that. And my time's running short, and I want to bring out one point. The respondent's not harmed by the decision of a collateral source issue. The respondent's benefits have been paid. She, under the law, Minnesota Statute Section 176.179, specifically states that if a workers' compensation carrier pays in good faith to an individual, but it's later found to be by mistake of fact or law, that doesn't need to be refunded. So and if I may finish, I see my time's
But I would also like to know, is that in the record that she's received workers' comp?
No, because it's a collateral source issue, and the collateral source statute, as the judge indicated, will not allow me to bring up workers' compensation because that's to be excluded to the jury under the collateral source statute.
Thank you, counsel, and you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Attorney, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you. Patrick Tierney, I am from the law firm of Collins, Buckley, Santry, and Hauk, and I represent the respondent, the D'Antonios. Two issues, and I think the court has focused on what we consider to be the significant issues. First, the review of the first issue of whether the trial court erred in not putting the parking lot owner on the verdict form. The review by this court is a de novo, is an abuse of discretion standard. We agree that under Lyons v. Ryan, all parties to the transaction go on the verdict form, but as the court has pointed out, they have to make an evidentiary showing that would allow the trial judge to put the parking lot owner on the verdict form. We have a slight disagreement on the standard that the trial court would use. The standard on determining whether the party goes on the verdict form is the Fry v. Snellgrove standard. If there is evidence of conduct, which if believed by the jury would constitute negligence or fault on the part of the person inquired about, then they go on the verdict form. You made reference to a prima facie standard that they have argued in their reply brief. I don't know that there's a significant distinction in the standards. But what they quote in asking this court to apply a prima facie standard is the Conda court, the Court of Appeals ruling in Conda, where the court is simply summarizing what the trial court found. And I quote again, in Conda, what this court said was the district court reasoned that an entity may be included on the special verdict form regarding allocation of fault only if there is a prima facie case under which a reasonable jury without speculating can assess fault to that party. Our position is simply this, and I think I'm talking about a legal issue, and if there's a ruling on this, I just want the court to apply the right standard. The standard is the Fry v. Snellgrove standard, the language from Fry that I just quoted, which we would argue to be the same as the Rule 50.01 judgment as a matter of law standard. A party to the lawsuit should be judged by the same standard as a party to the transaction when determining whether they go on the verdict form. So what the trial court did in this case, and what we would argue is the law, is that there must be a legally sufficient evidentiary basis before you can put them on the verdict form. Here, there wasn't. We disagree with the legal analysis of counsel on the duty. We are dealing with a premises owner, a landowner. The law is clear on that they're not an insurer of the safety. Just because it's dark in the parking lot does not make them liable. They must either show that the landowner did something affirmative, some affirmative conduct on the part of the landowner that caused this injury, or they have to show that the landowner had knowledge of a dangerous condition and an opportunity to cure that condition. There's no evidence in this case that would impose any affirmative duty on the landowner. There's no claim that there was a building code that was violated or an ordinance that wasn't complied with. There are a lot of streets in these cities that are not lit. There are a lot of parking lots that are not lit. There's no affirmative obligation to do that. In this case, their argument appears to be that the parking lot wasn't lit, therefore there's liability. But before you can get to that, you must show negligence, but you must show first that the premises owner had knowledge of that condition and an opportunity to correct it. Neither of those have been shown. In this case, there's no evidence, as the court pointed out, that as to who owned this building. A building owner can contract with a third party to maintain property. The test then would be whether the landowner exercised care in hiring or supervising that third party. We don't know whose obligation it was to maintain that parking lot. There's no evidence on that. No evidence who owned the land, no evidence of what may or may not have been done, no evidence of whether there was some kind of mechanical failure that caused the lights not to go on, no evidence of whether there might have been tampering that may have caused those lights not to go on. There's just no evidence. And that's what the trial court ruled here, is to allow the jury to consider this without any evidence of what the landowner supposedly did or did not do, if it was a landowner's duty to do it. You cannot put it on the verdict form. And as you also pointed out, a significant issue in this case is the causation issue. The police came to this accident shortly after it happened. We have pictures that show these poles lit, the ones that are lit. We have no evidence as to how close these poles that had not been lit were to the scene of the accident. There's no evidence of that. We don't know how much light they would have put off. There's no evidence of that. And no evidence as to how many of these poles might have been in the parking lot or where the closest one was. There's just not a shred of evidence on any of that. What we do know is that when the police came to the scene, the lights were on. We can tell by the pictures. And we can tell from Ms. Martinez's testimony that it was the condition in front of the car where this accident occurred. The lighting was no better after those lights came on than it was before. Any lighting that was available came from the building in this particular area of the parking lot. It did not come from these overhead lights. And that's what the testimony from Ms. Martinez was. She also testified that she didn't know if the lights were on or not that day. She didn't turn her high beams on. It wasn't so dark that she needed high beams on her light. It's just not a shred of evidence on causation, not a shred of evidence on what the landowner did or did not do that might have contributed or caused to this accident, or who the landowner is for that matter. So the trial court, we would argue, correctly ruled that there was no breach of any duty, no evidence that the landowner did anything affirmative that would have caused this, no evidence that there was any a special duty that the landowner had, as such as a violation of an ordinance or a statute, no evidence of causation. In fact, just the opposite. Ms. Martinez testified that the lighting in the front of the car was the same before and after the lights did come on. So the district court correctly ruled, and we would ask, it certainly did not abuse her discretion, we would ask this court to affirm the district court on the first issue. Second issue is the applicability of the collateral source statute. Here, there's no question that Ms. Antonia was paid about $162,000 in workers' compensation benefits. No question the travelers asserted a subrogation claim, and no question that the appellant had notice of that claim being asserted. We don't think the court need go any further than the statute itself, which specifically says 548.251 subdivision 2, collateral source statute does not apply where subrogation rights have been asserted. There's no question they've been asserted. That's the plain language of the statute. That ought to end the discussion. If it doesn't, we then have the Keenan case, the Minnesota Supreme Court case, which specifically held that the collateral source statute does not apply to sums received by the employee on a workers' compensation subrogation, where a workers' compensation subrogation right has been asserted. There's no authority that would support the argument they're making. Their reliance on this Kibaskuski case is simply misplaced. That does not involve the collateral source statute, period. It does not involve a subrogation right. It involves an independent right of indemnity created under the workers' compensation statutes that allow an insurer to make a direct claim against a tortfeasor, regardless of whether the injured party has made a claim or not. In fact, in the
Mr. Attorney, I'd feel remiss if I didn't interrupt. You know, I'm concerned about whether the matter on collateral offset is even properly before us. We have a district court judge that says, hey, I can't make a decision post-verdict on whether she was injured, whether this was a work-related injury or not. So as a reviewing court, how do we know all the stuff you're trying to tell us about her? I don't want to repeat your words because we don't have a court reporter, but something like it's clear that she received workers' compensation benefits. Well, how do we know that? The judge didn't make a determination as to whether she was hurt in employment, during an employment episode.
You are correct. There is no evidence as to what she did or did not receive. It is handled in post-trial collateral source motions. There's no dispute about it, but you are correct. There is no evidence of it. What would happen if this court would allow appellant's argument to go through is we're going to litigate every workers' compensation case in civil action, which is not what's contemplated by the collateral source statute. It clearly says that if the benefits are paid and if a subrogation right is asserted, that's the end of the discussion. If payment is made, rights are asserted, there's the collateral source statute is triggered. That is the language of the statute. I agree with you, Your Honor. There is no evidence on those things. It's handled in post-trial motions, and there is no evidence, no record of those things. But in the post-trial motions, we do put in evidence as to what was paid, and that the subrogation right was asserted, and that triggers a statute. That ought to be the end of the discussion. It's our position. They correctly quote the holding from that case, but it does specifically refer to subdivision 10 or the right, this independent right of indemnity that's uniquely created under the workers' compensation statute that allows an insurer to make a direct claim against a tortfeasor, regardless of whether the injured party makes a claim or not. It's a direct cause of action. They can't make that direct cause of action unless the benefits have been paid under the workers' compensation statute. That's because the cause of action is created by those statutes. What that case also says is that they find the issue of whether the subrogation right, if the injured party had made the claim and the insurer then asserted a subrogation right, the court in that decision says that issue is moot because the injured party in that case had paid an indemnity claim, had already made a payment. So the issue was moot, but it doesn't get to the issue of whether the injured party, had there been a verdict there, would the injured, if the injured party had made the tort claim, and if there had been a verdict, the court did not reach the issue of whether the injured party would need to repay those benefits out of the verdict. That was not reached. One step beyond that would be the collateral source issue. That case just doesn't come close to dealing with the collateral source issue that we're arguing today. So it's just our position on that issue. The statute itself is very clear what happens. The Keenan case is very clear that it applies to comp benefits paid, and the court is correct that those issues are post-trial issues decided as a matter of law after trial, but based on the language of the statute itself, we would argue it's clear that the subrogation rights have been asserted and that the statute applies. And we would just simply note that there is harm to Ms. DeAntonio. She is clearly obligated under the workers' compensation statutes to repay the money out of any proceeds she receives in this case. That same section, 176.061, says that if the employee receives benefits, the employee must repay, that the insurer has a subrogation right. You would be in a situation where if the appellant here, if Travelers had not made any payments, the appellant would be paying the full amount of the verdict because there'd be no collateral source at all. What they're arguing is because some other party made the payment, that appellant should get the benefit of that and not have to pay what it would otherwise be required to pay had the benefits not been paid in what they claim was a mistake of law. The equitable argument isn't there. The statute clearly states that these benefits are not a collateral source, need to be dealt with. Unless there are questions, Your Honor, I have no further argument.
Looks like there aren't any other questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney. Mr. Clear, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm sorry. I want to focus on the collateral source issue that Mr. Tierney had brought up. He indicates that in this situation, Travelers, being the workers' compensation carrier, as long as they pay benefits to Ms. D'Antonio and then assert a subrogation right against my client, that's end of discussion. That's not true. What Mr. Tierney fails to inform the court is that any indemnity right or subrogation right starts with the payments have to be made arising out of a workers' compensation or a work-related injury. That is for the employer to prove. In essence, my client doesn't have, the appellant doesn't have to prove that. What the workers' compensation carrier has to do is make a determination, and we're not going to try every case or litigate every case. There are cases that are litigated and that discuss whether it arises out of a work-related accident or not. And there is no harm to Ms. D'Antonio. If in fact Travelers would have intervened or Ms. D'Antonio would have requested that the jury or the judge make a determination before trial that this was a work-related injury, and that's determined either by a jury, by stipulation, or by the court, then we're not having this argument. But what the workers' compensation carrier, in essence, through Mr. Tierney, is trying to do is to say, whoops, we made a mistake in investigating this matter. We did not have to pay these benefits. We mistakenly paid these under the law or potentially mistakenly paid them under the law. And now we want our money back. My client does not have to pay Travelers, which is the workers' comp carrier, this money if it doesn't arise out of a work-related incident. And if that's the determination, Ms. D'Antonio, the respondents, don't have to pay that back to Travelers either. There's no harm here. And the issue in this case becomes—
Well, but Mr. Clear, isn't there harm if, I mean, because the jury found appellant liable, rather than appellant having to pay respondent for the injuries, now it's just requiring insurance to cover that cost. But ultimately, isn't that really the harm? I mean, the converse harm is to avoid double payments, but statute requires that any proceeds that she receives have to be paid back to the to her insurer. So that's really not an issue here, but it seems like if we were to follow your logic, Ms. Martinez would basically be having the judgment that the jury found against her being reduced by that amount.
She wouldn't, Your Honor. She's already received that amount. She has received the medical payments and the—
No. What I'm talking about is the amounts that appellant would have to pay out in essence, would have been reduced by the amount that has been paid by the insurer.
You're 100% right. And that's exactly what the collateral source statute says, is that, and unfortunately, I didn't write the law. It specifically indicates that if workers' compensation benefits are paid and they arise out of an accident, my client would have to pay the workers' compensation carrier. But the law states if the workers' compensation carrier paid benefits in error under the law, my client doesn't have to pay for those. And
what's your case law proposition that you are relying on for that interpretation?
That's the Kubaczynski case.
But that case relied on language from the statute that no longer exists.
That language definitely exists, Judge.
The language that I'm not even going to try to pronounce that case name, but
Kubaczynski.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and this still holds today. It's true that an employer and insurer, they have the independent right of indemnity, but they don't against a tortfeasor if they mistakenly paid workers' compensation benefits under law or fact. And I see my time is up, Judge.
Thank you very much, Fair Clear. Mr. Clear, any questions from other panel members? I see none. Okay. Thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing. Both were very well done. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That is the last case we have for oral arguments. So we will be in recess for our non-oral calendar. Thank you again. Please stay safe.
Thank you, Your Honors.